The men in the office thought that was pretty cool because no one had ever sent them a secret writing Christmas card.
Oh, my gosh. And a woman taught him. Oh, Lord, how did that happen?
And the operation was great. And that was the beginning of my stepping out of the darkroom. And eventually, I think I wrote in the book that I was on a train going down to Switzerland at one point with the turned out I was in the compartment with the president of the World Bank. I'm going to Switzerland to do a secret writing thing and a photo thing at the same time. And I thought, I like this job. This is a very cool job.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something, though, too, and I know this, too. Like I said, we had I grew up for a while in Iran. We were talking about that because, obviously, Argo was based out of Tehran, you know, the embassy there. And you're right. Certain cultures, they don't look at women. But I'll tell you who else overlooked women were the Soviets. The Soviets believed women weren't capable of doing it. And my first thought was Martha Peterson, right? You know, one of the first case officers to get rolled. They were surprised when she got rolled up on that. You know, obviously, they had were able to figure out there was going to be a meet, but nobody believed a woman could be a case officer. And I think that to our benefit and to their detriment, so many people underestimated you because you were a woman. And I think what a perfect cover, you know.
That was part of the rationale for sending Marty in the first place. She was the first female case officer in Moscow. And we knew from the beginning that she would have a good chance of success because they would not believe that we would use women. They wouldn't use women, and they just, you know, wouldn't believe that we would use women. So Marty, talk about a trailblazer. Marty was we all watched her very closely.
Yeah, and that was sad too when that happened too, because you think about you know, it happens, right? Our spies get caught, they get turned, you know, now we figure out when the meet's going to be, when the next drop's going to be. And, but hey, I wanted to ask you though, cause this is kind of an interesting for me point, but, a lot of times when you're working on a technology, like you deploy, let's just say a communication technology, at some point you've got to know, you're going to realize, cause it happens all the time, right? We know that this is going to get compromised, exposed. Somebody's going to get caught. Something's going to get happened. So it's not like you just work on that and then something happens. You have to start all over again. How far down the road, like you've got technology A, you know, a first generation, how far down the road are you on technology B, C, and D, like second, third, fourth generation, as you're using that first generation, you know, technology? In other words, when that one gets compromised, you've got to have the capability now to go to another system, you know, and a new system.
There are always technical people kind of doing blue sky, looking out at the horizon, what's coming. I know we used to work with DARPA for some of the really out of the box kind of solutions early on to see what was going to make sense, what was going to work for us. That was just a steady drumbeat in the technology world at CIA, always trying to stay ahead of the curve, because it was not just looking at something that might be useful to us, but it was looking at it from the other point of view of something that might be used against us. So you had to be offensively and defensively aware and engaged in, as these things came down the road. Tony used to say, he used to, you know, there was a shelf life of any technology before it would be compromised. And once you put it out there, the potential for compromise started ticking. And so Tony's point of view was we should be kind of stingy with our technology, because you give it to some case officer who didn't have the discipline, or maybe didn't even need it. It would just speed up the possibility of compromise. But once we got Soviets compromised technology, maybe we would grab one of their cameras or discover a piece of their equipment. Then our people would examine it and turn it backwards and forwards and say, you know, we could improve this. And we would take their equipment that we had gotten and we'd build our version of it. And then we'd put that out in the field. And then they would eventually get one of those and they'd look at our improvement. There was this thing going on over the years where, you know, rollover cameras, and theirs was really crappy, but I think it was the first one we saw. And we said, oh, you know, you just roll it over the document. So we made a better one, and then they got ours. And then we noticed later that theirs improved because they took our pointers. It was like two R&D groups
competing riffing, against each other.
Riffing off each other's work. It was strange.
Hey, but I wanted to ask you about that because it's an oxymoron to think of innovation and bureaucracy. Because, you know, a lot of things are so bureaucratic. I mean, like you said, you've got budgets, you've got projects and stuff. How do you drive, and for all, I mean, because you did this for years. I mean, you look marvelous, darling, but you have a lot of years of experience. And how do you drive that culture of innovation, especially when you're dealing with, you know, the CIA is like anybody else. It's a bureaucracy, you know, in one sense. How do you drive that innovation? How do you drive that blue sky thinking, keep people doing that and not get hamstrung by, well, we got to fill out our TPS reports and we got to file this form?
You know, when I was chief of disguise, I kind of bumped into that where we were doing, we were trying to invent that articulated mask that we eventually did invent. And there were a couple of times when I was looking at that thinking, I was looking at it with kind of a closed mind, thinking we just keep scratching at this thing and we can't get there. And I was reminded by some of my people more than once that you can't shut down on an opportunity or an idea like that, that you have to keep doing the blue sky thing. Otherwise, you'll just be stuck in the same old place over and over and over. So I think everyone is susceptible to that, to kind of walking away and dismissing new and innovative potential solutions. And I think I was at that point myself. And I remember consciously stepping back and saying, okay, go for it. You know, let's see what happens with that idea. For me, it was a conscious decision. I think some people just genuinely are born that way, but I had to learn that, and I learned it. I don't know how it works. I don't know what they're doing today, but back when I was there, sometimes having just a really fresh point of view on an old, tired subject is the solution, that idea that, you know, to break through the paradigm, you have to have an outsider maybe come in and kick the tires a little bit.
You do. And you become stagnant if you don't allow people to try new things. Oh, we can't do that because we've never done that before. Well, that's a ridiculous way of looking at things.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same theory. It's like I've been helping out an agency on a cold case homicide. They totally overlooked a key piece of evidence. And not it's just like this what happens when you get tunnel vision. You've looked at the same thing. But it was just something dealing with scrapes on fingers and zip ties that they told. And once you explained it to them, it was like, well, it could only happen this way. And all of a sudden, like the light goes on. And now that generates, but that could have only happened. I could have been the case agent, you know, the detective, and overlooked it. That's why with stuff like this, you always want to get that fresh perspective. But you mentioned something. And if I remember right, there is a picture of you. Well, I think a declassified picture, but wasn't there a picture of you in the Oval Office showing George H.W. Bush a new mask technology?
Oh, there was. It was a famous picture. I used to have it hanging on my wall, and I took it somewhere and showed it to someone, and I have lost that picture.
Oh.
Can you? And it's who gets to do that? And when I left the CIA, they kept all my calendars, all my written. And I had trouble for years trying to figure out exactly when did that happen. I didn't write it down. I didn't celebrate it. And now my picture's gone. So I love being reminded of it.
Well, this
was a moment.
Well, that wasn't the one they called the silver bullet package, was it? Was that something different?
I don't know the silver bullet package.
Okay. I might have got that wrong. I was just thinking that there was I was thinking of a disguise kit, but you also came up with something too, if I remember right, or you talked about it. It was called the 5-second mask.
Yeah, that's a name that was given to it. In that you could put it on and take it off, and squash it down and put it in your armpit and keep walking down the street. It only fit you, but the key thing about it was not so much the speed of putting it on. It was the way it articulated that you could actually wear it and sit in front of a camera or in front of a president like I am right now and have a conversation, and he would not notice it. That was doing the undoable. That's what I talked about. You got to have an open mind. You have to just sit back and let the people who are really good at this, let them be good.
But, Jonna, what I wanted to do, you know, with our remaining time is, like I said, and by the way, Murph, I've made a command decision. March 5th is a Tuesday, but we're going to release this on March 4th. So your episode will come out on March 4th, and we will pimp the hell out of your book.
There you go.
I appreciate that.
And the book, just so you guys know, it's called In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. I know they can find it on Amazon, but Jonna, have you got your own site too, or any place where people can go find out more about you?
Yeah, we've done a website, and it's so simple that even I can remember it. It's jonnamendez.com. And it's a little bit about the book. It's about the schedule. There's going to be a month of travel that I'm gearing up for now. We're going to be all over the place. And it shows where events are, when book talks are taking place. A lot of information like that.
Well, if you see somebody show up at one of your events and getting thrown out because they I know her, that's going to be me. So,
yeah,
okay.
I'm telling you now, Jonna, he's a creeper. He's a creeper.
And by the way, just so folks know, it's Jonna Mendez, Mendez, jonnamendez.com. And go and find the book. But I got to tell you, like I said, I'm a huge fan. I've gotten all your books, you know, I've read them. But let's talk about this book because I like the title of it because it's something I also want to get into as well with you. You talk about in true face. So there's disguise, there's true face. And then the same thing, there was a time without the advent of technology where you could have fake passports. You could do a lot of the stuff. And now in this modern era of social media and the use of biometrics and passports, true name, you know, having a fake name has become much, much harder. But let's talk about your book. Why do you call it In True Face?
It was just kind of a play on the fact that I was chief of disguise, and a lot of people, that's the connection that they make. They hear my name, chief of disguise, in a fake appearance. And In True Face to us was when your case officer walks into your lab and says, I need a disguise. You're looking at the man in his true face, and so I'm taking off my mask and just talking about my career, the way it worked, the way it went, what it was like.
Well, let's talk about that because what I liked. So let's put this in perspective. You start off as a secretary. No, you start off as a contract wife, graduate to secretary, kind of get topped out, threaten to go to the Smithsonian, and your boss says, no, we want to keep you. Start working photography. You go from that to being the head of the section. You go from, what was your official title? I know you were chief of disguise, but is that called an assistant director or director? Or what was your official title when you retired?
I was a division chief. Disguise was a division of Office of Technical Service. I was the chief of disguise.
And that was a position Tony held as well, too, right?
Tony was chief of disguise, yeah, about 10 years before I was. And then he kept moving up and onward.
Wow. So let's talk about that now. So now, your book, what propelled you to write the book? Because I mean, like you've already got some good books and look, let me tell you what, you folks go to YouTube, put your name in, you are all over the place. You've been on shows, you've been on interviews. In fact, one of the ones I liked is you made a bet. I think you got yourself in disguise and you said, I think it was for a reporter, but you walked into a restaurant, maybe it was in DC. And when you started taking it off, I think you were dressed like an older man or something. But you even mentioned something I thought was really cool, just to even change your gait, because gait is one of those things you can identify people by. You put a little rock in your shoe just to make you limp or change your gait. So, you know, what I'm saying is that there's so much of this information out here, it's hard to encapsulate it. But talk about your book. What propelled you to write this book?
The short answer is COVID.
Oh, there you go.
That inspired a lot of people to do stuff. Yeah.
I think we all sat, you know, looking at our belly buttons thinking, huh, what do we do now? I did maybe 20 puzzles. I don't sit still easily. And then I thought, well, you know, I could write down the story. And so I began with the idea of writing the story of my career, a memoir. I thought that would fill the time and could be interesting. There's also the fact that I'm really bad with dates, just generally bad. And I had written down some dates. I put all of it together and I kind of constructed, okay, that was my career. And then just started writing the story of my career. And the book got away from me in a good way, because I have to give some credit to Christy Fletcher, who has worked with Tony and I for the last 20, 25 years. She is the our literary agent, and she is amazing. She said to me, "Well, I mean, was it all this smooth? Let's talk about it a minute. Why don't you examine the bumps and the turns in your career?" And so I started doing that, and I tell you, the introspection, and I had time to be introspective, was very, very interesting. And then I kept, I was talking to her and I said, you know, when I was growing up, my mother was a working woman. She worked at Boeing in computers. And among all my friends, my mother was the only mom who had a job. So my mom was an outlier in that regard. And her career was this bumpy, lumpy road where Boeing would lose a contract and they'd lay off a whole bunch of people in Wichita. And you might appreciate this, because Wichita was a Boeing town. And then they'd get a new contract and they'd hire my mom back. And now she is working for the people, men, that she was training when she was laid off. And that was the story of my mother's career. She never really advanced. I know she was good at what she did, but the men just kind of kept moving by her. I started throwing that in, and then I started looking more broadly at CIA, at other women in CIA who had had issues. I started looking at the issues, started looking at some of the big reports that had been done over the years. And In True Face really took a different shape. It's not just about me, for starters. It's about women in CIA, but it's told within the context of being operationally engaged, feet on the ground, doing intelligence work as a woman. It's a lot to stuff into one book.
I love the way you wrote it. I'm glad that you put that in there, because it's, you know, I was in law enforcement for 38 years, and it was the same thing. It was a man's environment. When female officers and agents started coming on board, they faced challenges simply because of their sex, because of their gender. But the one that I just want to mention is when you were at the CIA training camp there in Virginia, and the guy rolls a grenade at you.
It was disarmed, or whatever the terminology is. All that was left in it was the loudest bang you ever heard.
Oh my God! Quite honestly, I'd have probably crapped my pants right there.
He wasn't trying to hurt me. He was trying to scare me. And I was determined. He was ticked off because of something that had happened. Well, actually, I had poured a beer on him the night before in the bar.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do.
He was sitting at a table with a group of Navy SEALs. I did that. So I asked for retribution. And I think I said in the book, I think what he wanted me to do is act like a girl. I think he wanted me to run. Most people would have run. I didn't run. I just stood there. Because I knew in my heart he didn't want to hurt me. But when that thing went off, I tell you, I may have had a tiny look at PTSD, because it was so close and so loud, and it scared me so much that I couldn't stop shaking for about, I don't know, 10 minutes. I couldn't stop shaking.
Wow.
Yeah. That was being a woman in a man's world.
Yeah, but that's a little over the top in terms of payback. I mean, rolling a grenade at somebody, even if it's, quote, technically inert, but it's still got the, you know, the primer in there, the charge, but still.
I knew in my heart of hearts that he would not have done that to a guy.
Oh, no. Yeah.
He wouldn't have done that.
There would have been some butt kicking going on that, on the other end at some point.
Yeah.
So yeah. Was there retribution after that involved? Did you, was that the end of it for you, or did you say, okay.
You know, I thought at the time that I could probably get him fired, because it was over the top.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't want to get him fired. So what happened was, he came to me and, he said, let's take a drive off this base that we were on. We drove. He said, "I'm sorry, shouldn't have done that." I said, "You're right. Okay." And so we kind of made a truce. Not a truce. I never forgave him. He felt better about it.
Yeah.
I saw him not terribly long ago, and hadn't seen him for a long, long time. Thought I'd never see him again. And I got a big hug. Like, oh, great to see you. Big hug. And I thought, you know, the way our memories work, the way we process things that we've done, he has somehow rationalized or removed himself from, I don't know, but it's not an issue. He doesn't remember it, I don't think. And of course,
you know what? He's probably giving you a hug because he knows you saved his career.
I don't know, but I was as surprised by the hug as I was by the grenade.
Actually, we're talking about it. One of the worst kept secrets. Oh, it's the base. I can't talk about it. Oh, okay. You know, the farm, Camp Perry.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's all like all over the place. But it's like we had a friend on Delta. Doesn't exist. It's Special Mission Unit Delta. We try to say you're part of Delta Force. No, Delta doesn't exist. Special Mission Unit Delta. So
yeah,
if we just say it right, we can say it.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Or better yet, you can say it and we can just nod.
That's not a denial. It's not a denial.
That's right. It works.
So COVID inspired a lot of books, but I think yours was important because we've seen this too with some of the folks we've interviewed. One of the people Murph worked or actually didn't work with, but we had her on our show. She's a special agent in charge of the Phoenix office for DEA, Sherry Oz. I mean, just amazing story of getting, and just the stuff they're dealing with all the fentanyl coming across the border, the opioids, the cartel, and the stuff she's doing. And I'll tell you what, she is as tough as any 10 men. But I think, you know, my concern is because when we grew up, my parents split up early. My dad was literally PTSD out of Vietnam. And you know, it was tough. Women had to work much harder than men did back in those days too, to just even get to be somewhat, you know, at the same level. And so when I read a book like yours or I see what you've went through, it's like, have we come far enough? Is there still a lot to do? When you look back at it now, you look at your career and you see the way things are going, are we where we need to be, especially in those areas?
I think a lot of women have moved forward, but I think every woman is kind of self-contained and they're always wanting to move forward a little bit more, a little bit more. So I don't think women will ever stop pressing the subject. I was talking to my son last night. He's spending the night and the day here. The heat is off in his apartment. I was talking to him about terrorism and narcotics and how when I started working, those were not really issues. And how terrorism really came first, and it was scary because it was almost like a religious. Very often, it was a religious belief that these people were inspired to do incredibly terrible things. But how and how we dealt with that at CIA. But then here came narcotics, and narcotics is a whole different mindset. Narcotics is about money, so much money. And how the lethality, in a way, from narcotics is more threatening than it is from terrorism. The terrorists believe what they're doing. The people that are doing fentanyl, the people that are doing drugs, the cartels down in Latin America, it's about money. It's about money, and it's such a powerful incentive for them to do outrageous things. So in my work, I was a lot more afraid of the cartels than I was of the terrorists. You know, the cartels were armed. The cartels were just so dangerous. They'd kill you in a heartbeat.
Well, and the difference between, like, say, the trafficking and terrorism, there is no consumer for terrorism. I mean, it's something that's perpetrated. But with drugs, this is what drives it. It's consumers. You know, we wouldn't have an opioid. I mean, to your point, 100,000 people die a year from opioid poisonings. Some of those are overdoses, but a lot of them are poisonings. And we don't go to war over that, but we go to war over 3,000 people killed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's capitalism at the most extreme, whereas terrorism is more ideological thinking. It's how I would kind of view it.
Apples and oranges.
Yep. It really is.
Well, let's talk about your book. So did you have for yourself, was there an aha moment for your book where you realized an insight that had kind of eluded you over the years? Or did you have any kind of an epiphany when you were writing this book of something that some clarity that came about because you went through the process of writing?
You know, there were epiphanies along the way. I mentioned Christy Fletcher at one point. I worked with a young woman, Wyndham Wood, who helped me structure some of what I was saying and certainly helped strengthen that book. And she had a point of view, although I wasn't working with her for her point of view. She influenced me in how I presented some of my scenarios. I discovered in the writing of this book that I am that I try and be more forgiving. I am less critical of what was going on than someone like Wyndham was, and she would kind of call me on it. There's a scene in the book where I'm in a foreign country. I'm in Europe. The job is done. It's downtime. The man I'm working with says, let's go see a movie. They show English language movies here. Let's go see a movie. So we go to see a movie. We go to see, it wasn't a pornography movie, but it was pornographic. I thought it was called Caligula.
Oh my God.
I didn't know anything about that movie. I don't know if he did. We went and sat down in a movie theater and watched this movie. And I got locked into this thing where all I wanted to do was leave. But I thought, if I get up and walk out, and when we go back to the office, this will become the joke in the office. She couldn't, you know what she did in the middle of this? She got up and walked out. So I basically sat there, closed my eyes, and I was like in a prison, didn't get up. I wrote about that. And she said, Wyndham said, why didn't he get up? I mean, this guy, you said he was kind of your friend. Why didn't he get up and say, come on, let's get out of here. This is not, but he didn't. And she said, there's the outrage that they were so, she got mad about it. Then I got a little bit mad about it. And that's in the book. But it sometimes took people outside of my story and outside of my experience to look at that experience and voice a little bit of outrage at what was going on. Outrage that maybe I felt, but I didn't want to be writing a book that was blaming the CIA for all of this. This was the American way of doing things back then. This is how it was for women, whether you were working for Boeing or working for the CIA, wherever you were probably encountering very similar scenarios.
Well, that's one of the things I like about your book. It doesn't come across as a poor, pitiful me. It's explaining, this is Murph's opinion here, but it's explaining how you went into a male-dominated environment, a career path, and you accepted the challenges that you faced there, but how you overcame the challenges, and you actually started, whether you'll admit this or not, you actually started leading a movement to promote women within the agency to show everybody, yeah, we can do the same job. You know, this is not just a man's job. And it's true in just about, I would say, every career path that's out there now. And, you know, I'm looking here. I looked it up before we started the interview. Did you think you'd ever see a female director of the CIA?
No, I did not. But history would show you that women at CIA have always done rather well on the seventh floor. That's not been a problem. They can run it. Gina Haspel was the first really public look at that. But there have been a lot of women in that hierarchy. That's okay. It's women in operations. I mean, we've had women analysts that have been really, really good. Women have had success in the CIA. It's in the operational piece of CIA that the men kind of drew a line. And they said, as a woman, you won't have any credibility here. You can't do this work. The women that I worked with toward the end of my career, I said, embrace it. The fact that you're a woman. The fact that I would meet with someone who was taking huge risks and potentially risking his family and their safety. And he would know that I actually cared about his family because I'm a woman. And he would know that I was taking extra precautions for him to ensure that he was going to be okay. Our men didn't exude that same kind of whatever it is. Women exude that. Men do not. It's not manly.
Well, and I think it's more of a male expectation. You know, I know I'm going to get a lot of hate mail over this, but that's the way I believe it. I have two sons, but I also have two daughters and five granddaughters.
Oh, well, you've got...
You are in for some drama, my friend.
Oh, let me tell you. That. It's ongoing.
There's that.
Yeah.
No, I think that being a woman, once I got out of the dark rooms, I think that being a woman was helpful in every case. If you were the opposition, you would underestimate me. If you were in the Muslim world, you probably wouldn't even see me on the same street.
Totally ignore you.
Yep.
Totally ignore me. So that was, if I was teaching you how to do whatever, whether it was encrypted communications or whether it was how to use my camera in a pen, I didn't let you go until I knew you knew what you were doing. And if you didn't get it, if you didn't understand it, you weren't going to lose any face by saying to me, could you do that again? Show me that one more time. They would say that to me. I'm not sure they would say that to the guys, to the men. The men would present it and say, you got it? And the foreign asset would say, I got it. And yeah, maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
The machismo thing gets in the way a lot of times.
I have an idea for your next book, and I get 10% because I'm your agent on this one. You just mentioned it. I love it. Out of the dark room into the light. You could write a whole book just on just that part right there, just on the technology. So you guys hear it now. Hear me now. Believe me later. Oh, by the way, I looked up my notes too. So I said silver bullet, but it was referred to originally as cloak, C-L-O-A-K.
Yeah, that's what Tony called it. That was his before we could say mask.
Yeah.
That's what he called it. And by the way, that agreement we just struck, I want my Python back.
You want your Python back?
You can have it.
This is going to be, we actually share an agent too on the other side. But the guy that I'm working with works with a lot of the big thriller authors like Brad Taylor and Jack Carr. Somebody from William Morris has already expressed interest in serializing the first book, turning it into like a series.
Huh.
So, okay, you heard it. She just gave up interest in that. It's going to be a big thing. I'm telling you, it's big. It's going to be big.
It's a fun idea.
But you know, to your point too, I was trying to think, I look at all these characters out there and I said, what do I want to read? And I thought, I've never seen a story about a police detective, but who has got a secret CIA past, you know, as an operations officer, you know? So he brings all those skills, because the thing I love is the kind of the motto of the CIA is we get paid to break the laws of other country, but not our own. And that's why many case officers, if they go true name, like you say, they reveal their identity. They are PNG for many countries because there's arrest warrants. Like, you know this better than anybody. How many people that you know of cannot travel back to Russia for fear of arrest?
Well, the number grows by the day as Putin
continues on his march.
Jeez. Continues on his march. It's scary out there.
It really is. It's ridiculous what's going on. You know, they were just showing. You'll love this. This is very timely. This morning is I'm away from home for several weeks, and in the mornings I'm on the east coast of Florida, and in the mornings there's several of us guys get up every morning, drink coffee, and watch the sun come up. And so we come walking back in. My wife's got the Today Show on, and there's an interview going on with Ukrainian military women. How many women are now part of the Ukrainian military? They cannot be drafted. So these are all volunteers, and they're not secretaries. They interviewed one who's a tank commander. There's one that's running, has been wounded already, and is back in special operations.
Oh my God.
It's amazing. And I'm just standing there, and they couldn't even sit down. You're kind of in awe of these people who, and you know the reason. I mean, they're protecting their country. It seems like we seem to be losing a little bit of interest there, which I don't agree with, but that's politics. But it's so motivating to see how people would step up. And then we look at our own country and we think, I wonder if the women in our country would step up like this, because I'm not sure all the men would.
It's hard to read our country right now.
It really is.
It's hard to do any generalizing about our country right now, because it's distorted, I think.
Yeah.
Well, let's not solve the world problems. Let's get back to talking about Jonna Mendez.
There you go.
And if you read her book, you'll solve a lot of the world problems. So again, pimping out the book, go get it. Go to Jonna Mendez, but go In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. But you know, but I think there's kind of a corollary too, because like you say, you were wearing a mask, even though you were in True Face, you were wearing a mask because that mask was people's belief that women could not do this job. So you were ignored by our adversaries, which is a good thing to play on. You don't want to go out and say, hey, pay attention to me over here. I'm really, I work for CIA, you know, because of the work you did, you weren't going out doing that. But what I like now that you're doing is you're kind of raising that flag, because I think places like CIA, so many great stories there that don't get told. People, like you said, you're listening to somebody, they find out you work for the agency and they go, oh, you're a bunch of murderers and killers. You know, I get so tired of hearing crap like that. You know, are there bad apples in any organization? Let's start with Congress. Let's start with
that's a whole series right there.
There's a whole, yeah. So don't folks, don't give me that crap. My neighborhood, and you know it too, I could throw a rock and I hit people that I know where they work, and I hit people I'm pretty sure I know where they work, and there's people I hit with a rock I have no idea where they work, but if I were to know where they work, you know where it would be. So that's a convoluted way to say there are so many secrets out here, but I'm glad you're kind of pulling back on it. For you, when you go, as you launch this March 5th, what's the big message you want to get out? I mean, for you, when you start talking about the book, there's talking about the book, but then there's talking about something out of your heart. What is it you want to get out about this book, about what it means to you?
You know, I like you said, I've done a lot of talking. I've talked to many, many audiences, and basically this book is kind of a continuation of those conversations. Every spring, there's a huge group of high school students that come to DC. They're part of a big program. It's competitive to get into it. These are fine, young high school students. They have a week in Washington, DC. They take them everywhere. They go to Congress. They go to the White House. They go places I haven't been. They have such an opportunity to get an overview of what it looks like, what their government looks like. And I'm the first person they meet on the first day, University of Maryland, 9 o'clock in the morning. I get to welcome them. And what I say to them is probably a distillation of what I'm trying to say in the book and what I'm trying to say in a lot of interviews that I do. And that is some version of, if you're going to spend your life doing something, why not do something that's worthwhile? Why not do something that makes a difference? Why not participate in your government, in your country? Do something that might, in some small way, actually be worth doing. I mean, I'm talking to these kids about not prioritizing going out and making $100 million, you know, in IT. Why not do something that involves policy? Why not do something that involves the presentation of this country to the world? Come to DC and take a look at what's here. And I'm not saying go to work for the CIA at all. There's enough three-letter agencies in this city to pique everyone's interest, whether you're technology, whether you're an engineer, whether you're a writer, whether you're a whatever, you can find it here. Why not consider making your life into something actually worth doing? Why wouldn't that be a reasonable goal? And I think that working at the CIA provided me with that feeling that what I was doing was helping this country make smart decisions, taking the information about the plans and intentions of people that didn't wish us well, so that we could form counter proposals. I came away from a career in CIA feeling good, like I did help. The joke was on me because I thought I was walking away, and we have never been more involved. Then after we left the CIA, we just kept coming back full circle to the same subject. You know, the Argo movie, a whole bunch of books, a whole bunch of speaking. I was out at CIA 3 years ago to S&T, to DDS&T, where they presented me with a medal. It has nothing to do with me. It's the Antonio J. Mendez medal with his face on it, etched in it. And anybody can vie for it. Anybody can try and win it. So to win it, the criteria, they're written down somewhere, but basically you have to do your version of Argo. You have to confront an impossible situation, kind of a one-off with no obvious solution. You have to come up with a solution that might be very out of the box. Then you have to do what Tony Mendez did. You have to sell it. And in CIA, when you're going up to the area division chiefs and you're trying to sell this idea that we're going to make a movie and we're going to set up an office in Hollywood, we're going to take out advertisements in the Hollywood Reporter and Variety. Selling that was, Tony said, that was the hard part of Argo. Was getting the and it goes clear up to the White House, and then it goes to the Prime Minister of Canada, and then it goes to the ambassador in Tehran.
Yeah, because Canada had to pass a special law to allow us to use their passports, and they did it in secrecy.
Absolutely.
God bless them. But, you know, here's the thing. Okay, boss, here's what I want to do. We're going to go to Tehran. We're going to make a movie, and we're going to sneak six people out of the country right after the revolution happened. You know, everybody's looking for Americans. What do you think? That's kind of like you going into Germany going, hey, I don't speak German. I have no work permit. I don't have a place to stay. Will you hire me?
You think I should get the medal?
I think you've already won the medal. Why aren't you having it?
No, it was the whole thing, but the idea that they have struck a metal, and you have to do almost impossible. Oh, and it has to be successful. That's the final line, and then they will award the Antonio J. Mendez Medal to you. So somebody asked me not long ago, have they awarded one? And I said, I have, and I never will have any idea if they have awarded one. It'll be done in total secrecy.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. But this has to be an actual operation, right? This is not just like
an experiment.
It has to be an actual operation.
This is dead serious. If you do the impossible and just pull it out of the hat and carry it off, in addition to many other things that'll happen to you, you'll get the Tony Mendez Award.
Hey, I was going to ask you on a serious note, too, because we always, things that are near and dear to our heart are people who gave their lives in service of this country, you know, here and abroad. I know at the CIA, there's a memorial wall. They etch stars. And sometimes you don't know. Sometimes they wait. And correct me if I'm wrong, but sometimes they wait maybe a couple years to put something on, because putting a star on too early would give away potentially the identity of somebody. But are there stars on the wall that you have personal affiliation with?
Yes. And there were moments when I thought I was going to be a star on the wall. I mean, when you have guns pointed at you and you think this is how it happens. It comes out of nowhere and it's not even personal. It doesn't have anything to do with you except that you're an American and you're in the way. That's how you get to be a star on the wall. It's a very sacred place. Because some of the people, some of those stars will never, their names will never be known. Some aren't. But boy, there are stories there. Ted Gupp wrote that book to talk about some of the stories.
For our listeners here, you're listening to a true American patriot hero on today's interview with Jonna Mendez, because she has faced danger. She just said she had guns pointed in her face. I mean, think about what your life is. Have you encountered that? You know, the fact that she excelled and progressed through a male-dominated environment, an extremely competitive environment. And now that you – I think you retired in 1993. Is that right, Jonna?
Yes.
And you took an oath when you joined CIA, right?
Oh, absolutely. Took an oath.
So, and the reason I ask, I know all the answers to this. The reason I say that is we've coined a phrase that just because we retire does not mean that our oaths ever expired.
Oh, look,
that is fantastic.
Hold on a second. I'm going to do, is that for public disclosure? Hold that up there.
I don't know.
Pull it back just a little bit. I'm going to get a screenshot. There. Got it. Perfect.
That is very cool.
That is the Antonio J. Mendez medal.
Isn't it great?
That is amazing.
Advancing tradecraft through technology.
That's awesome.
I think it's unprecedented.
Very nice.
They don't strike medals for individual people. It's like they don't hang pictures of individual people in the hallways.
No. Well, but that just, anyway, kudos to you. You know, look, we're going to be closing up here in a minute, but the reason I kind of teased this story at the beginning, I want you to close out with, I think, was one of the most fascinating stories about when you and Tony got married up near Harpers Ferry, Virginia, West Virginia. This went back to an operation where you were able to get somebody, and it's in the book, so I'm not going to give anything away, but you were able to get somebody very valuable to the United States out of Russia using deception, misdirection. And was it known to you or unbeknownst to you when this person, I believe, and his wife show up at your wedding?
It was unbeknownst to me. That was not an operation I had anything to do with. It certainly became known to me after the fact. That was an exfiltration that took place, getting someone out of Russia, getting some ones actually out of Russia. And Tony was known for exfiltrations. He took part in many of them. Each one is more exciting than the next, but I don't know of any that actually failed once they decided that they would move a person or even move a family. That one in particular was just very interesting. The idea, I mean, part of the MO, part of the modus operandi that Tony set up was you wanted it to be done in such a clean way that when the KGB went looking for whoever it was that was gone, they would find, it was like a little bit of a stage set. They would find a half a cup of coffee on the breakfast table. There would be that daily newspaper. There would be no sign that anybody had packed anything. No photographs were missing. The silver was still there. The person just disappeared. And so the Russians would announce that they had been kidnapped. They had all kinds of reasons for what had happened. They never, ever would say that their person, you know, had betrayed their country, Russia, the motherland, and been rescued. It was just that they had just disappeared. You couldn't go visit the grandparents with the grandchildren to say goodbye. There was none of that.
It was like witness protection. Once you leave and you're gone, that's it.
You just simply aren't there anymore. And I was at a musical event 2 weeks ago. It's a salon in the afternoon here in the Washington area, where the last one, there was a piano, a violin, and a cello, classical music, beautiful, beautiful afternoon listening to this music that close. And I met someone who came out that way. I met the wife of someone. She came out. They both came out. And I was just blown away that here they are all these years later, and we're sitting here listening to it was Shostakovich we were listening to. And you just are reminded how real all of this is. This is people's lives.
But you know, the world has changed so much too, because I think of people that were former adversaries. Now they're living here, you know, or they come here a lot, like Viktor Chertikov, you know, he ran Alder James. He ran Robert Hansen. Writes a book, and now somebody you used to run operations against is now somebody people go to lunch with, you know, out in the open. I mean, would you have thought that at all possible during your time at the agency, is that we would have gotten to that point?
Oleg Kalugin, of course,
yep,
is exhibit A there. He's we've known him for years. In a way, everybody's doing a professional job. Not the assassins, not the Russians who are out there poisoning Navalny, not that group, but the professional people in the intelligence services that are trying to steal the other guy's secrets. There's almost an honor among thieves there that you've done a good job for your country. It doesn't surprise me nearly as much as you might think.
You know, Morgan, I mean, that carries over with us. Who did we interview on our podcast? William Rodriguez, who took over the Cali cartel after his father and uncle were extradited to the United States.
George Young, Pablo's business partner. Jose Navia was popped coming out of
Luis Navia.
Luis Navia. I mean, 26 tons of cocaine in a ship.
It's crazy, well, and it carries over the same thing that John is talking about here.
A guy who was a shot caller for the Mexican mafia. Mm-hmm. Did time for murders. I guess it wouldn't surprise us because we've talked to everybody from both sides of the law. It's just the world has changed so much. But I think to your point, what's going on now is far different than I think what we were going through during the times of the Cold War, you know, when it was the Soviet Union, you know.
I think it was Milt Bearden where I first saw a real change. He had been chief of station in the subcontinent where I worked with him. And then he was chief of a Soviet East European division at CIA. But after Glasnost, all of a sudden I saw Milt Bearden in newspaper photographs, and he was like touring the United States with what we would call liaison officers from Russia with representatives of the KGB. And they were having these friendly trips, and they were going out to California to look at some technology. And I thought, Jesus, the first time I saw that, I thought, he's with the Russians, he's doing this. But yeah, I think there are these friendly relationships that we could not have imagined them. Mm-hmm. But now they're very real.
Yeah. Well, John, I got to tell you, I mean, I'm like I said, such fanboying it. I could go on for hours, but you know, we're going to bring this to a close. But I do want to bring it to a close by just again telling people go to Jonna Mendez, JonnaMendez, JonnaMendez.com. Get her book when it comes out March 5th, In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Make sure, and while you're there, buy Argo, buy the other books too, like Master of Disguise by Tony, Spy Dust, The Moscow Rules. If you want to know what life is like, this is where you get the real deal. I can't. So look, I owe you a drink, the Afio luncheon or whatever. Like I said, I'm over here in Ashburn. When you launch your book, if you're going to be around in the local area, I'm going to get onto your site. I'll find out where you are. Just please, I ask you one favor. Don't have them kick me out. At least let me get an autograph.
Well, I didn't know what to expect from you guys. This was actually great fun. I have to say, it's not always great fun. I did a piece for Wired.com for the Spy Museum some years ago. And I sat in their studio up in New York, World Trade Center 1, looking down at those ponds, did a piece that I thought was probably just embarrassing. I thought it was just going to be so awful. It's been seen, my son reminded me last time he looked, 23 million times.
Wow.
And my son said, Jesse advises me on all things. He said, just don't look at the comments, Mom, because people can really be mean, especially when they get to do the comments.
Oh,
so
yeah.
As he went out the front door, I went to the comments and I looked, and people liked it. That was the beginning of my discovering that this is an interesting subject and that people are tuned in and they're interested in it.
Well, I hate to give Murph some credit too, but just the same with you, for some reason, the things that you wouldn't think innately that would be interesting. Pablo, shocker, folks, spoiler, Pablo's dead. He's been dead for a long time, and yet we still continue. How many times a year, Murph, are you asked to do something about Pablo?
Oh my gosh, it was the 4 years before COVID, we were averaging 75 shows a year around the world.
Wow.
COVID killed us for 2 years. Now we're doing about 25. But, you know, I keep a running list of all appearances and interviews that we do. It is now, and that's since, you know, this is our ninth year. It's over 14 pages long now.
That's a tribute to something wonderful.
Fascination.
I get a lot of hate mail, I'll tell you that.
Well, Jesse Mendez, my son, is who turned me on to Narcos. And, you know, I didn't know it was there. I probably wouldn't have even wandered across it because I'm not curious that way on anything digital or anything on TV. And we were glued to it the whole time. It was just wonderful.
Well, Murph stayed friends with Boyd Holbrook, the actor. We had him on a few episodes back, so we got to talk to Boyd about
what it's like to portray me.
Hey, John, one more thing, too. I actually got this, too, from the CIA. This is a challenge coin. We meet up. We'll talk about that, but it's It's a Comrade KGB challenge coin. So,
all right. Oh, I want one of those. I haven't seen that. That's cool. That's very
John,
cool.
Well, before you meet up with him, you might want to do a little investigating here because he sounds like a spy.
Check him out.
Yeah.
He's got an awful lot of gadgets there.
He does.
Hey, I did instruct for a while. I taught interview and interrogation behavior analysis out at the NSA National Cryptologic School, but we were teaching to the damage assessment agents, people doing polygraphs and stuff. And I wish I could have got them to unlock some of the stories, but they would just hint around some things. But some of these guys were involved in Ames, Earl Edwin Pitts, who was FBI, Nicholson, you know, many of these spy cases, Pollard, you know, folks like that. So to CIA's detriment, they don't tell the stories that they ought to. And I know it's tough to get some of those out, but if you could go back into the archives and unlock things like Air America, you know, and some of the great stories that CIA has done. And that's why I'm glad you're doing this. I think people, it's tough to defend yourself when so much of the stuff you do can't be talked about. So we're trying to find ways we can talk about those things.
You know, I think of it as humanizing the CIA, which has become just such a target for this kind of vitriol that comes out of nowhere. And it's because people don't know. So they know a little more after I talked to them than they did before. Yeah, I met
you
them.
Folks have just got a master class, a PhD level class. So this counts for 3 credit hours in your continuing education. Send in your form with $50 attached to gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com, and we will get you a certificate.
Or sign up for Patreon.
That's right.
Well, there's cheesy commercials.
I think you two are having entirely too much fun.
Life's good.
Should be outlawed. Well, look, let's bring this to a close because we've consumed a lot of your time and we would continue to do so. But hey, look, John, seriously, this is us saluting you. You're a great patriot. You've served our country in ways I know you can never talk about. But we're so glad that the things you can talk about that you've shared with us and everybody else out there, I'm telling you, go to johnamendez.com, get the book, In True Face of One's Life in the CIA. And if you show up at one of her book signings, tell them you heard about it on Game of Crimes because we get $50 from her book every time she sells one when we're mentioned.
Just an aside that you, just for you two, People Magazine is doing a piece. I've taken a peek at it, and it's supposed to be online today, and it's going to be in the magazine this week. It's 4 pages of.
We'll link to that. We'll link to that on our episode page for you too. And we've got some of those pictures. Hey, by the way, too, before we close out, you sent a couple of those pictures. One of them is a black and white picture showing like open and closed, and you've got like this. You've got the 60s hair. It looks like the black.
Oh yeah, in the 60s dress.
Yeah. What is that? What is that from?
That was when I was working in that photo lab, when I was the darkroom gal, and I was taking, I would take all kinds of pictures of stuff that came in, but there was like a concealment device that we had made. It might've been a briefcase. And I was photographing for the instruction little manual, how to get into the secret space in the concealment device. And that was just a tripod and some lights. It was a little studio set up there to photograph whatever we needed.
It looked like one of the original selfies.
It does.
I don't know who took that picture. I would never know. The one you missed was the best one, and I didn't use it, but we had an African-American OTS officer who worked with us in the dark rooms in the photo section. It was his birthday and he was gone. We didn't like him. Nobody liked him. So while he was, this is my first disguise assignment. While he was away, I went and to the disguise people, and I got 6 afros, 6 black mustaches. We all had on white lab coats because he always wore a lab. And we had this group photo, everyone in disguise, disguised as him. It's a great photo. But
how did he take that?
I don't know.
That remains highly classified, Murph. That is special access, code word, eyes only for presidential, review only.
I got you.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Jonna, again, thank you very much. This episode will come out on March 4th, and we will help launch your book Into the Stratosphere. So remember, we're your agents, 10%.
I'm so glad I talked to you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, don't go anywhere, John or Steve. You guys hang on. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. You know, we're recording this before I'm down there for the session, but I can't wait to hear this because all you have to do is go to YouTube. She's been on so many shows. She's this whole thing about disguise and espionage and some of the operations that she was involved with. Mm-hmm. Just, but you know what's more impressive, Steve? She starts off as a contract wife. At first, I thought it's a contract wife, like what, the ones you order from Russia, yeah. Mail order bride? You know, no, contract wife. You know, you'll under, you've, now that you've listened to the show, you understand what that means. Worked her way up into doing operations. I mean, she was tenacious and worked her way up into being the head of the unit, the chief of disguise, the chief of the unit.
And her book, you got to read the book because her description in our interview, we just didn't have enough time to go into the minute detail that she does in her book that will, you'll learn how far they are willing to go to create these disguises, to train other people to do things. She'll talk to you about secret writing, all the different things that go along, and the stories where, you know, couple guys that she encountered. She had, it was a lot, it's a male dominated society back during that time. But as she said in her interview, there's two in particular that she points out, and you'll get more detail in the book. It's a book that once you start reading, if you're interested in spies and the spy work and everything, you're not going to be able to put this one down. So we highly recommend you get to her book.
In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. It's available on Amazon. It's also on our webpage. And I got to tell you, Murph, the other thing too is just, the creativity. I mean, I just was so amazed at the creativity involved with this, that it takes to do this stuff. But hey, you know what? The other fun thing though, too, as you find out, I saw that picture and she can't find it. The one where she was in president, the first George Bush, H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. and they were using that disguise package. And when she took it off, she impressed the hell out of him. She says she's still looking for that picture mm-hmm. and can't find it. It reminds me of that. What was it? One of the license plate, Pablo's license plate that got lifted from one of your backyard events.
Yeah, that's a gift from the DEA guys in Colombia when Connie and I were leaving. It was, they had a Colombian license plate stamped and it had Pablo's name on it. And of course, you know, sometimes you don't know everybody comes into your backyard and somebody took home a souvenir.
I'm still on the hunt though, Murph. I will track this bastard down.
Please do.
I'll do it in disguise with help from Jonna and they won't know who it is because I will be so good at this. But hey guys, I'm serious. This is, it's a true honor and I'll be, yes. By the way, remember, good Kansas girl, Wichita State, go Wooshocks, you know, Kansas girl, Kansas rules again. Come okay. on, say something bad. I dare you. I'll have her make you disappear. She'll disappear
you. You know, I'm not afraid of you, but John, I am. I think she still has connections.
You know she has connections. She says she doesn't, but you know she does.
Oh, she helped set up the spy museum. You know, that's honorable right there. And John, thank you again for being on the show. It was a true pleasure. Had a great time talking to you.
Even she said she had fun. She didn't know it was going to be that fun with us, but we're fun guys.
And we are. We are. And that's what this whole podcast is about. Game of Crimes is letting people come and tell their stories. So we're going to continue to bring great guests in here.
Absolutely. Well, guys, if you like that, then head on over. Hope you enjoyed it. Head on over to Apple, Spotify. Tell us what you thought about this great story with Jonna Mendez. Hit those 5 stars. It's magic. We don't know how it works. David Blaine, David Copperfield, even Houdini. Just go over there, hit the 5 stars. Head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. Her book's listed there. You can find it on Amazon. Remember, her book is called In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. And you can visit her at her site, jonnamendez.com, to see where she's going to be doing book signings, go out and do that kind of stuff. And also head on over to that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also head on over to Facebook, type in Game of Crimes fans, and our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. Well, if you are deemed worthy, which most of them are, I don't know of anybody we've kicked out other than I almost wasn't let into the group and I had to say, no, look, I'm one of the hosts. Oh, really? Sorry. You know, we had that discussion early on. so we'll let you into the group and also head on over to Patreon. I'm telling you, patreon.com/gamercrimes. We just had some fun over there talking about Wind River, Jeremy Renner. Dude. What a great movie. We've got some other great stuff coming up too. 911, what's your emergency? You can't make this shit up. Case of the Month. We did some really good cases too on Case of the Month. Our Warden of the Throne. And the more you contribute, the more stuff you get access to. So patreon.com/Game of Crime. So Murph, I think we've wrapped it up again. 135 attempts to keep us off the air, and yet we're still here.
Yeah, thank you so much for continuing to support us. Please tell your friends about Game of Crimes. The more we're trying to grow the podcast as much as we can, there's not a whole lot of marketing you can do with a podcast except through your listeners. So we rely on you guys to get the word out there for us, please.
Word up. Get the word out there. Word up, people. And thank you once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous, most secret, most clandestine, most espionage-filled game of all, the Game of Crimes.